Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. When it comes to speed, Americans like it fast. Fast money, fast cars, fast food. And you'd think, for a country where so much of the web was pioneered, that our internet would be able to keep up. But it doesn't, according to a recent report from the New America Foundation. Joining us now from Washington, D.C. is one of the authors of that report, Patrick Lucy, of the Open Technology Institute, which is part of the New America Foundation, a nonpartisan think tank. Welcome to the show, Patrick.
Thank you for having me.
This is the second report of this type from the New America Foundation. The last one was in 2012. Why is the foundation examining this issue?
Well, the goal of our work is really just to sort of simulate the consumer experience in different countries. So we visited the websites of the major internet service providers in a bunch of different countries operating in major cities and just tried to collect as much information as we could to see what kind of prices people were paying. And what we found is that a lot of the time you can get a lot better service for a lot less money in other cities.
In other cities, in other countries?
Yes.
How does the speed and cost of American internet service stack up?
Well, there are a bunch of different rankings out there. In the U.S., in the early 2000s, the U.S. was ranked usually very high. In the last couple of years, it's dipped down. And depending on the study and the release, the U.S. comes in between 8th and 14th. That's sort of echoed in our research as well, where some cities in the U.S. actually do quite well and have some of the fastest speeds in the world. And I can talk about those later on. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, it's really the prices and speeds are actually quite limited. And, again, the major issue is really a lack of competition in the U.S.
My guest is Patrick Lucy. He co-authored a report on internet quality from the Open Technology Institute. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. It's Tech Tuesday. If you have a question or comment for Patrick Lucy, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. So, Patrick, can you give us an idea of just how much faster the best cities in the world are? I guess they're Tokyo and Seoul?
Right now, sort of the main buzzword in technology policy and looking at broadband speeds is a gigabit per second, mm-hmm. and that is 1,000 megabits per second. And to put that in perspective, your typical home residential connection is probably between 10 and 20 megabits a second. So this is the fastest speeds that are available in some cities are up to 100 times faster than what people typically have at home. So, yes, you can get gigabit speeds in Tokyo and in Seoul and in Hong Kong, but you can also get it in some American cities as well, such as Chattanooga, Tennessee, or in Kansas City through the Google Fiber project.
Okay, so before we move on to Chattanooga, because dying to know about that and why
yep.
that is and why there's this discrepancy,
yep.
What does it look like for a consumer to have that much faster internet access? I have no idea what 100 times faster than what I have now, except that I do feel validated now for all my toe tap and when my internet doesn't go on, pop up fast.
Well, the key thing is just to sort of not be constrained, and that's what people really, you get an internet connection and you don't want to worry about it, you don't want to think about it, and you don't want to have it be limited. And that's actually where a lot of the debate in the U.S. comes about whether or not, the level of competition is really about the level of competition for medium or faster speeds. So in May, the FCC put out an Internet Access Services report, and they showed that for most of the country to get 10 megabits or faster, most of the country really had only two options and maybe only one. And that's really the faster speeds are important because households now, it's not just one desktop mm-hmm. that, serves the family, people have to share it. Everyone's got their device and tablet, and they're using it in their Wi-Fi. And so just the amount of bandwidth that is being used per household is going up. And so it's really important for speeds to be able to serve the needs of a family, not just an individual.
What is the problem? Is it that the companies that provide it don't have the technology to get it to all of us, or are they just trying to profit at the lowest level possible?
Well, there are a couple reasons. Internationally, some of the cities that we looked at, some geography and density plays a role. You know, it's easier to build networks to a lot of people if a lot of people are living very tightly together. And some of it is also the domestic policies and how much the countries support new entries and competitors in the marketplace. And that really, again, is the problem in the United States, where, again, most people have, you know, maybe one or two options for a really fast connection at their home.
Mm-hmm.
In the city of Amsterdam, there are actually seven different providers operating. And granted, those seven providers are not available at every single address in the city, but mm-hmm. still it speaks to a level of competition that is much different than here.
I imagine that Chattanooga is a very bustling city, but I don't think of it as some major, you know, highly populated, major, with high density, like I say, would think of as a San Francisco or a Washington, D.C. or something like that.
Yeah.
So what's the deal?
Well, the reason why we included Chattanooga in our study, and there are two other American cities that we included as well, Bristol, Virginia, and Lafayette, Louisiana, where you can also get gigabit per second speeds, is because they have municipal broadband networks. And these are local networks that are built by the city, usually in coordination with a local electrical utility. And they're really this communities that have decided to say, you know what, it's really important for our town as a whole to have really good access, and we're going to build the network ourselves. And so they're really about treating it, the broadband access, more like a utility and meeting the needs of their schools and businesses and residents.
In the United States, we fancy our economy is the most competitive in the world. That's what we're all about, is competition. That's the American way,
mm-hmm.
right? So why is it that we only have, just a handful of choices in a place like Columbus versus, you know, someplace that has, in Amsterdam, that has seven?
Well, one of the sort of policy areas is called open access rules. And these are rules that allow competitors to lease access over another provider's infrastructure. So in the U.S., we don't have any of those rules. So the only way you can compete is if WOW builds another cable line to your house, you know, to compete with Time Warner Cable. In other countries, it varies to the extent and the details of the open access rules, but there is the ability for competitors to lease access on infrastructure. So it lowers barriers to entry and allows more choice at certain households.
Mike in Columbus, you are on the air with Patrick Lucy. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Last summer, I was trekking in Eastern Europe, Albania, Macedonia, and these countries. Mm-hmm. Albania is a poor country, one of the poorest in Europe. And especially while I was there, I stayed in a little old town with a poor infrastructure, Berat, and mm-hmm. I stayed in a B&B, and I was staying in low-end places. I had my laptop with me. I noticed that my Wi-Fi connection, my internet download speeds were really going mm-hmm. well, and I saw these poor people. I saw teenage boys herding sheep with sticks at the side of the road, yakking on the cell phone all the time. I finally mm-hmm. asked a couple of the different people who were running the B&Bs, and these aren't rich places. They're people who are letting out a room or two for some extra money. And I said, how do you guys afford this? You've got this cable TV with 100 or more channels. Everybody's yakking on their cell phone all the time. You've got good internet connection. How do you afford it in this country? They said, well, it's $20, $25 a month or something like that, for that combined. So I don't know what's wrong here, but it's possible for us to provide that kind of service very cheaply, and we're not getting it, and they are.
Mm-hmm. Is that kind of typical, what you found, Patrick Lucy, in your work?
Yeah, I mean, nothing helps like competition. I mean, that's really what the name of the game is. That's what makes Google Fiber so interesting. I know that's another city that I mentioned and referenced, talking about how Kansas City also has a gigabit per second speed.
Mm-hmm.
And Google Fiber, this is a project where Google is actually becoming their own internet service provider, and they're building their own infrastructure to serve customers. And it's the first city is Kansas City, but they're also going to be building in Provo, Utah, and Austin, Texas. And it's clear that as soon as a viable competitor shows up, all of a sudden, Time Warner Cable, who's the main cable provider in Kansas City, all of a sudden they start increasing their speeds and not raising their prices and just sending customer service representatives door to door to actually talk with customers to say, hey, how are things going? We really value you as a customer.
Uh-huh.
And so, it's clear that when there's viable competition, service providers can improve and they respond. It's just most of the time there is no real push to get that kind of market dynamic.
Thank you, Mike, for that call. We appreciate it. When it came to Chattanooga and Bristol, Virginia, mm-hmm. and Lafayette, Louisiana, that
yeah.
you mentioned, and they decided to build their own network, their own municipal network,
mm-hmm.
politically, do you know much about the politics of that and how the internet providers came to?
Oh, well.
Did they have a fit or
there's
what?
There's been
what?
A lot of politics. So in those states, it became very contentious at the state level. And in in 19 different states so far, there has been state legislation that has either banned or severely limited cities from doing similar kinds of behavior where cities build their own infrastructure. And again, most of these pieces of legislation are actively supported by the telecom industry.
Is Ohio one of them?
Oh, let me
can we check that real quick?
Yep.
Ohio is one of them. Okay.
But there's when a municipal network becomes operating and actually serves residents as well, that has the same kind of behavior where it prompts faster speed upgrades and better service from the incumbent provider.
What about the okay, go ahead.
Oh, no.
What about the bundling that we do in the United States? Is that pretty typical? You said even in Albania, they bundle, I guess, it all together now.
Yes, but the bundles are a little bit different. Oh, Ohio is not a state that has any kind of limits on communities building their own networks, just to answer your question there.
Yeah.
And to get back to the sort of the types of bundles, mm-hmm. well, in most other countries, the bundles don't include as many channels. There's more of a support for public broadcasting, and people can get more channels over the air. But that's actually probably what American consumers would want as well. Like, prices for bundles have been going up. The number of channels has been going up. But people don't necessarily watch all those new channels.
That's for sure.
And yeah. And so it's a matter of saying, well, you pay more, but you get more. But what consumers really want is to pay less and get less. And that's why there's now more of a debate about a la carte cable channels. So you can, have more control over what you want to subscribe to as opposed to, these giant sort of take it or leave it bundles.
Well, Patrick Lucy, I really appreciate you joining the show today. It's been really mm-hmm. interesting. Thank you.
Well, thanks for having me.
Patrick Lucy, he co-authored a report on internet quality from the Open Technology Institute, part of the New America Foundation, a nonprofit think tank. If you want to get a link to that, we'll have one on our website at wosu.org/allsides. And coming up, we're going to talk about blogging. So stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on Tech Tuesday on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. On the web, millions upon millions of sites compete for our attention, from Facebook to the Huffington Post to a blog from your neighbor down the street. Anyone with access to an internet connection can put it out there, but getting anyone to read what you've posted can be tricky. A new blogging site called Medium has been getting some attention recently for its tactics. Joining us now by phone from Oakland, California, to tell us more about Medium is Alexis Madrigal, senior editor at The Atlantic. Welcome back, Alexis.
Thanks for having me.
So who's behind Medium?
Right, so it's one of the founders of Twitter, and also Ev Williams, who also created Blogger, which was a popular early blogging site, eventually purchased by Google, and people continue to use it today. And the idea behind Medium was to create a more beautiful place for text on the web, and part of the package there was sort of de-emphasizing the standard unit of blogging, which was like that an individual sort of voice and personhood would be foregrounded. In Medium, that stuff is sort of pushed to the background, as are most of the other things that we tend to associate with blogging platforms.
Can you put Medium in the context of other familiar platforms like Tumblr and just a regular WordPress blog?
Sure. Yeah, it looks more like a Tumblr than anything else. But Tumblr has a lot of sort of social features mm-hmm. enabled, in the sense that people tend to, for those who aren't familiar with it, people tend to heart, they tend to like things a lot, they tend to reblog things a lot. Mm-hmm. And in Medium, the modes of interaction are really different. For example, you know, most people are used to how comments look, you know, on newspaper articles or just, you know, most websites. They're at the bottom of the article, mm-hmm. right? And they sometimes they're threaded, sometimes they're not. People are experimenting, but most people hate comments, or at least hate other commenters.
Right.
And what Medium has done is place them in line. That is to say, they sort of show up inside the story itself, kind of off to the side.
Okay.
And so what it allows people to do is comment on individual elements within the story. And they've also given the creators of the blogs, sort of by default, they only comments that the writers approve show up.
Huh.
So they're trying to create a different sense of safety in writing, community, collaboration, via the design of, you know, just redesigning these small elements in the sort of interface of the platform.
I like the idea that the comments are connected to the element that they're referring to. But the idea that the writer gets to control it, you know, as a journalist, I think that's kind of interesting. And I'm wondering, I also know that right now it's by invitation only. So the people who manage this invite people that they think will play the game, you know, will invite critique and not just censor everything.
Right, right. It's an interesting thing. I mean, we have this idea that sort of developed in the early days of the internet that, in fact, comments should be an open season in some sense. And I think that just sort of happened. Like, I think that there were some ideologies of early web people that openness and transparency were sort of values that should be promoted. But it's funny to think back about it. I mean, it was kind of contingent. If there'd never been a comments field, would people have missed it? Or, like, if you got to the bottom of an article and instead of a comments field, there was a way to send an email to the author of the story just built in right there, would that have become the standard thing? It's kind of a fascinating place to run sort of counterfactual scenarios. Because right now, I think most people would say the way that comments work is not totally satisfactory.
I think you're right. And yet I think that it's also been one of the things that has built up interest. You know, the fact that I can, not me, but someone can put it out there and everyone has to read it, or at least they're kind of on equal terms. It's just kind of got them coming back over and over and over again, much to the chagrin of some people.
Definitely, I think it, as a way of increasing the interactivity of sites, especially at a time when, you know, in the early days of the internet, when there weren't other ways of doing it, I think it was very significant.
So it was invitation only. The sites only recently opened up to general users, and we're talking about Medium once again. Can you describe how its launch has unfolded over the past year or so?
Yeah, it was really interesting because at the opening of the launch, they just released sort of login credentials to a really small number of people, most of whom associated with either Silicon Valley or in New York, what's called Silicon Alley, similar types of people involved with startups, involved with technology. And they tried to organize the site into what they called collections around particular topics. And other people could create collections, but there were a few that were sort of promoted by Medium itself. And what they tended to be looking for were kind of aphorism-heavy kind of essays about life. They weren't, you know, this wasn't supposed to be news blogging. This wasn't supposed to be Live Journal, another early blogging site that was known for its sort of emotionally open kind of posts. This was supposed to be, you know, considered, edited things that told you stuff about life. Like I feel like this, for good or for ill, the post that defined Medium in those early days for me was a startup marketing guy who wrote a post saying, you must have a go-to salad in life, in which he describes how he and his wife for years have had a salad that they make for dinner that allows them to sort of stay healthy, and it's easy and it's fast and, you know, helps them avoid sort of fast food. But it was sort of couched in these terms of sort of like, this is wisdom that's being delivered.
It sounds sort of like TED Talks of blogging.
It had a little bit of that feel, right? Uh-huh. Like you could read 700 words and your worldview would change by 1 degree. You know what I mean? It was like it was something like that. And it was interesting in part because if you were in the media business, like, you know, I work for The Atlantic, obviously I have a stake. I have a horse in this race. Mm-hmm. It started to look like, as the year went by, a little bit more like a magazine in the sense that, you know, you had these sort of thematic collections. Medium itself started to promote on its front page and through email newsletters a small subset of the posts that were made, maybe like 7 posts a day were getting a lot of attention. And Medium posts began to show up. Obviously, there's the longstanding connection with Twitter, but they started to show up on Facebook, on other social media sites, just like the sorts of stories that The Atlantic does, or The New Yorker does, or that NPR does. And I think that it started to seem like, is this actually not a platform, that is to say, you know, like Blogger or like Facebook, but it's actually more of this hybrid between a magazine and a platform. And they've hired, in fact, the former editor of Wired.com. Hmm. They've hired people who I have previously hired at other publications, and it starts to, you know, it's hard to tell where the line is anymore between what's a platform and what's a magazine.
Do we know who's getting paid by Medium and who is not, or if anyone is at all?
Well, I think that's one of the things that's so fascinating is, like, in a platform, like, no one was paid for Blogger, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, people just created blogs and they made stuff. Tumblr's kind of the same thing. But Medium has paid without necessarily making this a very public discussion. They pay a subset of writers to use the platform, which, again, that looks much more like a magazine model than it does like a platform mm-hmm. model. And part of that meant that they had pretty elite writers writing on Medium. They've also purchased actual content companies, one called Matter, which was a Kickstarter-funded science and technology magazine based out of the UK that they actually just bought and said, you're going to bring your stuff to Medium, these long-form journalistic things. They also, the magazine, which was co-founded by it's just called The Magazine, which is co-founded by one of the creators of Tumblr, also has been brought to Medium as well. So they've been acquiring content, they've been paying for content, and they've been getting a bunch of other content for free. So you start to think about the model, and it starts to look pretty good in the sense that they can aggregate a large amount of stories and thinking and writing while only paying for a small percentage of it.
You know, I by the way, you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. It is Tech Tuesday today. It's on 89.7 NPR News. If you have a quick question for Alexis Madrigal, we're talking about Medium. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You heard Ed Williams, Twitter founder, this morning talking about the public rollout of Twitter. How does Medium make money? What do their ads look like?
They don't have any.
Okay, so what's the secret?
Well, right now, they're sort of bankrolled by Twitter's success and the ability of the founders to essentially fund it out of pocket.
Okay, nice for them.
Right. I mean, there's a few different ways you could imagine this going. There could be a product that they actually end up selling, perhaps one of the collections, the best things collected, something like that. Mm-hmm. You could also imagine in a world, you know, with what's called sponsored content. It's kind of a term of art in digital media right now. It basically means posts written by companies or representatives of companies that run just like other stories. So it's pretty easy to imagine Medium selling sponsored content space. It's basically an ad by another name. And that seems very easy to imagine as kind of a monetization strategy. Other than that, I don't know. You know, the thing that's interesting is not that many people end up going to medium.com, you know, like you might go to the newyorktimes.com.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people receive Medium posts through social media outlets, and because they don't run ads on those pages themselves, it's hard, and in fact, a big part of Medium is that, and then one of the reasons it can look beautiful is that they don't need to fit ad units in right now. It's hard to imagine them starting to include, you know, traditional ad units. So they have a real distinct advantage over the media companies that are actually trying to make money.
The magazine you work for, The Atlantic, has a relationship with a site called Long Reads. Can you describe that and contrast it and compare it with Medium?
Yeah. So Long Reads primarily highlights work that's already running in other places. And there are other companies that do similar things, longform.org, a site called The Byliner, although The Byliner tends to commission more original work. And it was all kind of, I think, you know, if you take all these things as a whole and you say, is there a trend here in the way that the internet works? I think that what you would see, or what I see in it, is that we had a time in which everything got shorter and shorter and shorter. Everything got faster and faster and faster as people tried to sort of, you know, play by the rules that they thought would garner the most attention and traffic. And then you had, over the last year or two, a lot of media people as well as media consumers sort of stepping back and saying, you know, maybe I want things that are sort of slow cooked. Maybe I want things that are going to take me a little more time to get through, that are a little longer, mm-hmm. but are maybe meatier and more substantive. And I think as you see people switching more and more of their media consumption from print products over onto the digital side, you find people saying, hey, you know, I like reading a long thing now and again. And I think you'll end up seeing a mix that's more like, you know, a newspaper of yore, when you would have long articles, investigative pieces, and you'd have essays, and you'd have short things about the news. And it won't just be what I think a lot of people thought the internet was becoming, which was like a zillion short items pumped out at, you know, a million a minute.
So Medium is in between, or?
Yeah, I think the thing, Medium strives to feel like a slower place, if that makes sense. Just in the way that the content reads, it's not that kind of rat-a-tat fast style that maybe people got used to from, you know, the Gawkers of the world, the Huffington Post of the world.
And do you think people are applying to get to post on Medium? Is this something people are vying for now?
Oh, yeah. I think people like it. I think if, you know, there are a lot. Yes, I think people are applying. I think Medium is successfully recruiting writers to their site, both paid and unpaid. And I think the real question is, as they try and make money, how are they going to spread the wealth?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a big question. I don't know.
Alexis Madrigal, thanks for joining us today to talk about it. I appreciate it.
That was fun. Thank you so much, as always.
Alexis Madrigal, he's senior editor at The Atlantic. We will continue with Tech Tuesday. Coming up will be Russell Holly from Geek.com. So stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Welcome back. It seems like almost every week on Tech Tuesday, there's a new mobile phone to discuss. We've got two new iPhones a few weeks ago, and this week, a new phone from Google. It's hard not to wonder if these tech companies are just spinning their wheels or if there's real innovation going on. Joining us now to make sense of it all is Geek.com tech blogger Russell Holly. Welcome back, Russell.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
All righty. So another phone with a name and a number, the Google Nexus 5. How does it stack up to its predecessor, the Nexus 4? What do those numbers mean anymore?
Well, so Google started the Nexus program a couple of years ago as initially as a kind of a jab in the direction of carriers, where you could buy this phone, you know, completely unlocked from them and put it on whatever, you know, carrier you wanted to put it on. And that has been difficult to accomplish over the last couple of years. They've tried with a couple of different phones and haven't really hit their mark. But one of the things that I found really interesting about this phone was that it seems more possible than any other smartphone that's out there today. And what I mean by that is you can take a SIM card from T-Mobile, a SIM card from AT&T, or even a SIM card from Sprint and stick it in this phone and it'll jump up and start working with the service that's attached to it. And that's something that hasn't really been done in such a way that the user can just kind of pick up a phone and do that before, which has been pretty powerful.
Why is that? What's the difference? How are they doing this?
Well, so a lot of it has to do with the hardware that's inside of it. You know, we've had over the past couple of years wireless radios that are very specific to the individual carriers. Each one of the carriers has their own wireless spectrum that they broadcast their service to. And a lot of times you'll have carriers that you'll have phones that can support, you know, the wireless bands for you know, one network or two networks. But this, you know, theoretically supports all four of the major U.S. networks with a slight exception to Verizon. It only covers about half of Verizon. The idea is that this radio that's inside of it will be able to cover all of these different networks with a single service.
Does that affect what it's able to do?
No, not at all. It's still a very capable phone. It has a very nice 1080p screen with a very fast processor. This is really just kind of the evolution of the wireless radio that's inside of the phone. And what you're seeing from Google especially is a very inexpensive device compared to a lot of their competitors that is just as capable of some of these other top-of-the-line phones. You have to figure that the iPhone 5S is $649 off contract. If you were to buy it and just stick it on T-Mobile, you'd have to pay $649 before tax. And the Nexus 5 offers all of the same basic features running Android instead of iOS, and it's $349.
And the idea is you don't have to bundle. Now, this maybe is for people who don't get cable, who don't have other things to bundle with it.
Well, so I mean, if you uh, if you wanted just a prepaid service,
yeah.
you could buy a SIM provider from a prepaid service if you wanted to, you know, have your AT&T service. And then in the middle of, you know, your contract decide that you wanted to leave and go to Sprint. Maybe you've moved across the country and AT&T isn't any good in the new area that you are. Mm-hmm. You don't have to change your device. You can just move to the other carrier.
Okay. So you put Geek.com put up several posts comparing the Nexus 5 to other top phones. How does it measure up?
So far, it's definitely a really powerful device. I think going into the Christmas season, this is probably going to be one of my favorite phones. It's hard for me to pull away from some of the other devices that I've been using recently. I'm a huge fan of the HTC One and the Moto X.
Mm-hmm.
So it's hard for me to stay for sure. I've only had it for a little while now. So when we get closer to doing Christmas stuff, I'll have a lot more to say about
it. How many phones do you have?
It's kind of an embarrassing question to answer. You know how, like, you're not supposed to ask a woman how old they are? You shouldn't ask a tech blogger how many smartphones they have.
Well, I'm just wondering how you actually test it when you have so many.
Well, because I have a series of things that I go through. I have a really stringent policy, actually. It takes me about a week to go through a series of tests, and I compare it to all these other phones doing the same tests. My house is covered in phones, though. It really is.
Do you ever get them mixed up? Do they all start to look alike?
No.
Okay.
No, they did, not to me anyway. To everyone else, I've actually to my daughter sometimes I've asked my oldest daughter to go get me a phone, and she's had to try 3 or 4 times to get me the right one. You said the white one. Well, yeah, but I meant the white one with the black stripe. So that is a thing that happens for most people. But when you're kind of soaked in it like I am, it becomes less of a problem.
And how does it compare to the latest iPhone 5S?
It's definitely a different experience. You don't have kind of the same rigid lines and firm, you know, metallic feel that you get from the current iPhone. As far as holding it in your hand, it's a 5-inch screen instead of a 4-inch screen. So it is going to be bigger. If you've got smaller hands, it's going to be less convenient. But it's just as fast in every way. It's a very powerful device.
And then you mentioned the Moto X.
I do love the Moto X.
You do love the Moto X. Remind us, what is so special about the darn Moto X?
Well, the Moto X has a lot of really unique features to it, something that no other smartphone manufacturer is doing right now, with, you know, the ability to use the phone even though the screen is off, you know, the ability to look at your notifications without waking the phone, the ability to speak to your phone and get it to do things even though the screen is off. I could be driving and say that I wanted to hear music from a specific artist and it would just start playing.
Wow.
Or I could call a friend or I could send a text message and I don't ever have to touch the phone to do it. And it's a lot of really specific technology to make it work, including this new thing that they're doing called Spotlight Stories.
What's that?
Spotlight Stories is this. It's probably the coolest thing I've ever seen a smartphone manufacturer do. Think of it like you're holding the phone up. We've talked about augmented reality before. This mm-hmm. is kind of a similar concept, but not exactly. It's like watching, for this particular example that they gave us, the first one is called The Windy Day. And it is almost like a Pixar short. And you are watching the Pixar short through your phone. But instead of just watching, you know, holding your phone in your lap and watching this kind of static thing that plays out on the screen, as you move around with your phone, you're actually following along with the story. So you start off watching this little red hat, and the red hat gets caught in a gust of wind and it blows away. And instead of, you know, holding your phone in your lap and waiting for the next thing to happen, you follow the hat with the phone by turning your body and you know, holding the phone up in the air. And it creates this really interactive experience that is just really powerful. It's really fun to sit there and do it. It's, you know, maybe 5 minutes of your life. but it was just this really cool experience. It's hard to appropriately describe. And the guys at Motorola have been working on it for a while now. They worked with the director behind the Pixar movie Ratatouille
uh-huh.
To develop this particular short, and they're actually working on a whole bunch of other shorts to put in this. They're basically creating this content channel that's going to be exclusive to their stuff for this you know, interactive kind of storytelling experience that I thought was just incredibly cool.
That does
and my
sound
kids
really cool.
Absolutely loved it.
Oh, I bet. So the phone in and of itself is entertaining you.
Yeah. I mean, this is something, you know, it's a unique experience for so many different reasons, you know, being able to use that. And it's hard to put in words, you know, how different using the Moto X's compared to other phones, because on the surface, it really does just kind of look like a regular smartphone. But after about a week of using it, you realize that you're pushing buttons entirely differently. You're reacting to how your phone does things in an entirely different way. And it's cool to see that kind of change from you know, kind of this normal swipe and tap thing that we've been doing for the last couple of years with smartphones.
What about the camera on the Nexus 5?
So that's kind of a mixed bag. There's a lot of really new technology in it, and I can't say definitively if it's, you know, the best or the worst camera out there. It is definitely better than a lot of the Android cameras that I've used in the past year. It is probably not as good as the camera on the iPhone 5S. It's certainly not as good as the camera on the iPhone 5S when you need to use flash, just because the flash on the iPhone 5S is a whole new kind of technology that that no one else is really touching right now. But it is a decent kind of middle of the road camera. I think that for most people, if you were to pick the phone up and compare it to another phone, you'd have a hard time pointing out specifically what was better about one than the other. But I wouldn't say that it is definitively the best. It is a nice camera.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's Tech Tuesday, and my guest is Russell Holley, tech blogger for Geek.com. If you have a question or comment for Russell, you can kind of ask him almost anyone, which is what we have in an email from Susan that we'll get to. If you have a tech question, give us a call. Maybe Russell can help you out. 614-292-8513. And again, you can email us at allsides@wosu.org or check out Facebook and post your question or your comment there. Russell, before we move on, well, wait a minute. Let's finish up with the phone thing here now. Nexus 5 will come out with the latest version of the Android operating system, KitKat. Again, food related, sweets related.
Well, dessert.
It's dessert.
It's always dessert.
It's always dessert.
It's an alphabetical list of desserts. That's okay. their
version. Kit Kat. I don't eat Kit Kats for dessert. I sneak those.
Well, when do you eat them?
Secret. actually, they're my associate producer, Amy Jurovich's favorite candy, I think. She's nodding. Yes, they are. So, anyways, we know what the deal is with the name. Anything about the operating system that we care about?
There's tons of stuff about the operating system that we care about. It's you know, the next iteration of their operating system to include just kind of a generally faster performance. It's really going to just kind of take the existing Android experience that anyone who has bought a phone within the last year is used to, just kind of streamlining it. So the buttons are all going to be in basically the same place. But you're going to notice things like Google Now is going to be, you know, kind of just a swipe away from the left-hand side. And, you know, access to a lot of Google's features is going to be, you know, much easier to get to and kind of a much smoother experience all around.
By the way, the alphabetization of the names, the last one was Jelly Bean, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Now it's Kit Kat. Do they have to pay for Kit Kat?
No, that was actually an interesting story. It was kind of a happy accident. It was originally going to be Key Lime Pie, but through just kind of almost a whimsical negotiation with Nestle and Hershey, they worked out this deal with Kit Kat.
Do you have a prediction about what will be next? Lemon drops?
I have no idea.
Okay.
I honestly was really confused about what they were going to do with Kit Kat, because they had never used a like an actual consumer product name before.
Yeah.
So it's really anybody's game now. They've kind of opened the door. Maybe someone will create a special candy in the next year just to get the L name for Google.
Interesting. Okay. Licorice. Okay. All right. So Amazon Kindle first.
Yeah. This was kind of interesting. I'm really interested to see how this works out. The idea is that Amazon's publishing service, they have their own publishing company, is going to offer up a new service to Amazon Prime subscribers, where you can actually pick certain books that are going to be coming out across the Amazon publishing service, be it on the Kindle or you know across their other e-publishing venues. And you'll be able to read either portions of the book or the entire book before it actually comes out.
But first of all, I should have asked you to tell us what Amazon Prime is, what it costs, what people get for their money from that. It's extra.
Amazon Prime is an extra subscription that they offer that they've kind of tied into a lot of things now. It used to be that Amazon Prime was a shipping service where you paid, I think it's $100 a year, unless you're a student, there's a discount for students, but you pay that $100 a year, and anything that fits, that has the Prime logo next to it when you go to buy something on Amazon, you can get free two-day shipping or $4 one-day shipping on no matter what the size or weight or anything of the thing that you're buying is. And that's actually really useful when you go to do things like, you know, buy a 150-pound mattress and you only have to pay $4 to have it shipped overnight.
Yeah.
So that service started out as just kind of a shipping bump, and then they tied in their video streaming service where you have kind of Netflix-style, all-you-can-eat video watching across their service, as well as the ability to purchase movies the day that they come out and kind of add it to your library. And now they are adding this Kindle First service to it as well.
Do you have to be a Prime member to get Kindle First?
You do have to be a Prime member to be able to pick the specific titles and set it up. They are going to make it available to non-Prime members eventually for $24 a year.
Hmm.
It is included in the Prime subscription.
Why do you think people would want to pay just to get their hands on an ebook a little bit faster?
I think you answered the question with the second part of the sentence.
Okay.
When you hear about things like imagine this isn't something that's an option right now, but imagine J.K. Rowling, for example, has decided that she's going to write a short story for Kindle Publishing Service. They paid her a great deal of money. People would pay significantly more than $24 a year to be able to read that before it came out.
Hmm.
Just because of who the author is.
Okay.
And so I think that that's going to be the real tie-in there is, as long as Amazon can, put compelling authors behind the Kindle publishing brand, then that'll drive interest, people who want to, get the book as early as possible.
We have an email from Susan. She asks, can you ask your guest about Republic Wireless and their upcoming launch from non-beta and whether it's a good deal? Do you know what she's talking about?
I do. I've been a Republic Wireless user tester for almost 2 years now. It is they're kind of a carrier in the same way that they're kind of not. It is a wireless service that you can purchase that is mostly Wi-Fi. It is designed for people who are connected to wireless networks, more often than they are not connected to wireless networks. So the idea is that you get a significantly cheaper monthly service, knowing that most of your calls are going to happen over Wi-Fi, but you do get, a regular wireless 3G service to happen afterwards in case you are not on Wi-Fi. So it's a basic wireless service. It's an inexpensive wireless service, under the guise that you are going to not use it most of the time and instead make calls over a wireless network.
So what about this upcoming launch from non-beta?
So they've been doing this beta thing for a year and a half now, where they worked with Motorola on two phones, and they had these phones where, as long as you were connected to a wireless network, you could make calls. When you weren't connected to a wireless network, you were using Sprint for your voice and your data, and it was unlimited all the time, regardless of which service you were on. It was, unlimited data, unlimited voice for very inexpensive, like $35 a month. Kind of inexpensive, and it got a lot of really positive responses. But in order to make that work, they had to make sure that their internal networks could actually handle the traffic that would happen when, a quarter of a million people go to make a phone call all at the same time. So they've been in beta for a while, making sure that the network worked, making sure that their customer service agents were, trained in doing the stuff that they were going to do. And now they are going to kind of officially launch the service where you can just sign up online and get the phone the next day and be connected to the service.
And it's a good deal?
It is a good deal if you do not care about, having a reasonably fast internet connection.
Okay.
If you use a smartphone for, downloading movies or watching movies or playing games or You require that smartphone access for your job, then it probably isn't the best idea.
Okay.
But if you use your phone mostly on wireless networks and a smartphone is just kind of a fun thing, then it's absolutely something that you should, you know, keep in mind.
Okay. And we don't have time to get to our last segment, but I want to remind listeners, around Thanksgiving, Russell's going to start his annual Christmas list. So if you have questions about things you're thinking about getting people for Christmas, send it into our email at allsides@wosu.org, and we'll make sure Russell can talk about that. Russell, Holly, thank you so much for joining us, as usual.
Thanks for having me.
Russell Holly is tech blogger for Geek.com. Thanks for listening to Tech Tuesday today on All Sides with Dan Fisher. This is listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of WOSU Public Media.
Support comes from the law firm of Thompson Hine, delivering employee benefits solutions uniquely suited for your business. More information about Thompson Hine's employee benefits practice can be found online at thompsonhine.com.